So is everybody still awake? You want to do some jumping jacks? Maybe we can get done before 6 o'clock. What do you think? I noticed some of these other people giving lectures, they didn't do the whole hour and a half, did they? So, you know, I guess there's no moral obligation that we actually have to stay here till 6 o'clock. I just wanted to give you, this is just an example of a VerbNet class. So this is the contiguous location class, and there's some of the examples of the verbs like border, cover, edge, and these are the thematic roles. So this is like Italy borders France. So this would be like one of these symmetrical predicates where, you know, there's no agent-patient relationship. They're really, the two things have very equal status. And those are the numbers there are the links to WordNet senses. So for border, this would match WordNet senses 1, 2, and 5 for border. And so then there are all of the syntactic frames. I think there's more than one here, so I just put one example. And then at the bottom, there's some semantic predicates. And these are actually quite similar to Jackendoff's lexical conceptual structures, but they're not second order logic. So there aren't predicates embedded in other predicates. They're just first order logic. And they're just simple things like here, there's some sort of a contact relationship between the two themes. And this is just giving you some temporal information that this relationship exists during the whatever the time duration of the, whatever sort of information you get from the sentence with respect to how long this bordering thing lasts, the contact relationship lasts that same amount of time. So again, similarly to Jackendoff, we certainly weren't trying to cover the entire meaning of the verb with these semantic predicates. We were just trying to hit a couple of highlights. So just a couple of sort of major things that are entailed by this particular verb. There would certainly be lots of, if you were trying to do some kind of very complete representation, there would be lots of other things you wanted to add to that. But this should be, this contact relationship should be valid for all of the verbs, all of the senses of the verbs listed in this particular class. And then here's, there's another class, the fill class. The cover is in both classes, the border class and the fill class. The fill class has three thematic roles, an agent, a theme, and a destination. And then it has slightly different syntactic frames. And then the predicate is, there's a location predicate. So the one of the things that's conveyed by the verbs in this class is that the theme is at the destination. The location of the theme is the destination, whatever those things are defined to be. So I just wanted to give you those examples. Okay, and then I also added, this predicate here about the automatic semantic role labeling, that just to sort of summarize that, it's basically a three-stage process. So the first step, if you're given a bunch of text and you want to automatically tag it with semantic role labels, the first thing you do is parse it, and the parser of choice is Charniak's parser. So now you've heard all about it. And given the syntactic parses of these sentences, and given that you've got a particular verb and you want to label the arguments of that verb, one of the first things that you want to do is filter out the noun phrases in the sentence that are not likely to be arguments of that verb. And since the Wall Street Journal text, the sentences are fairly complex, there's usually a couple of subordinate clauses in addition to the matrix clause. So you'll have, like, you know, typically three different verbs with arguments that you're trying to annotate. So you've got, so you know, two-thirds of the noun phrases in that sentence are not really of interest to this particular verb. You use the syntactic structure and the domain of locality of the verb to sort of zero in on the arguments that you think are the ones that are most likely to be arguments to that particular verb. And so that's the pruning and the argument identification process. And then given that you've got these two or three arguments you want to label, you then try to assign the correct label to each one. So now, if you've got questions, if anybody has questions about this automatic semantic role labeling process, I'm happy to answer them. If not, we can just carry on. I don't see any questions, so shall we carry on? Going once, going twice? Okay. So there was a question earlier about the fact that we, given that ARG1 had all of these possible mappings to VerbNet thematic roles for all the different verbs that had ARG1 labels, how did we decide to group them? And so actually the Karen Kipper, who's been one of the main people involved in creating the VerbNet entries, she proposed this grouping. And the idea was that, so obviously patient one and patient two would be things that you would want to group together. Product is really just a kind of slightly more specific type of patient. Okay, so those things would go together. The theme is, this is kind of a similar idea here. She sort of knew better than anybody else when she had used predicate, stimulus, and attribute, and when she had used product, so it was her idea that these went with theme and that product went with patient. These over here, I'm really kind of worried about. Agent, cause, and experiencer ought to be arg zeros, according to everything I've been telling you guys. Now, notice that's only 4% of the arg ones, so there's not very many of them, but even so, we need to go back and look at those classes and make sure that there hasn't been a mistake in the way we've done the mapping. And again, one of the reasons we did the grouping was, I mean, notice even with these four things grouped together, it's still just 4%. So there's obviously not very many examples. So we were trying to, you know, group similar things together in order to get just greater quantities of training data for each different example. Did that answer your question, or did you? Well, they're certainly similar semantically, but the hope is that they're also similar syntactically. So you would expect these things to behave syntactically more consistently than the whole group. That these subgroups you would expect to be more coherent. And that is more or less what was borne out in the results we got. That the training data for these subgroups was more consistent, and therefore the system trained on that training data performed better on the testing data. So here's where, remember, the theme of this series is supposed to be sort of empirical techniques for doing things. So what's interesting about being, now that we've got all this data and we've got these semantic roles labeled with different levels of granularity. So we've got the prop bank, very general role labels. We've got VerbNet. We've also, and I'll tell you about this in a minute, we've also mapped VerbNet to FrameNet. So we could look at the FrameNet frame elements, the labelings of those for the same data. So now we can play around with these different levels of granularity. We can try to decide which level of granularity actually gives us the best results. Maybe these aren't, you know, this was our first pass at doing these groups. Maybe we should try some alternative groupings and see if we get even better results or if the results get worse. And so this gives us a sort of an empirical approach to trying to decide what's the most useful way of labeling these thematic roles in terms of being able to generalize them to new verbs and new instances. New syntactic usages that we haven't seen before. Any more comments, questions about this semantic role, the labeling stuff? Well, Okay. So then I'll get on with So this is the beginning of the third lecture. Okay. So we've really talked about both the manual semantic annotation and the automatic semantic annotation. So I want to talk about parallel prop banks and event relations. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about the relationship between the prop bank frame sets and the VerbNet verb classes and WordNet as well. So you remember we started with this example about the successful, what do you call the successful movie, and that we wanted the computer to be able to automatically distinguish between something like call the police and calling a successful movie a blockbuster. So the prop bank frame sets actually do give us exactly this kind of distinction. At a very coarse level, coarse grain level, they recognize that these two sentences would have the verb call would have a different number of arguments. If you look at, if you ask Jeeves, who do you call for a good electronic lexical database for English, you get WordNet. I think, is everyone familiar with WordNet? Yeah. Is anybody not familiar with WordNet? No, okay. We have tried to use WordNet for you guys know about the SenseEval evaluations? Okay, so there's been three of them now. They were originally primarily just word sense disambiguation sort of evaluation. So we would provide training data and test data for different languages, sense text, training data, sense text, test data, and then people could evaluate their systems with this data. It has grown, so the SenseEval 3, which was the workshop was at the ACL conference in Barcelona in 2004, included some FrameNet, frame element tagging, and some logical form representations. So in fact, the call for SenseEval 4 is on the web now, and they're changing the name from SenseEval to SemEval for semantic evaluation to sort of recognize that it's become a broader, more inclusive type of evaluation. We tried to use WordNet to do the sense tagging for SenseEval 2. And we've continued to use it for SenseEval 3, and we're even using it for SenseEval 4. But we've had some real problems with it, because when you give a sentence with, say, call as the main verb to two different taggers, and you say, okay, find the WordNet sense, given WordNet's entry for call, that you think is the most appropriate for this particular sentence, and you give that task to two different people, they only agree about 70% of the time. So that's what this inter-annotator agreement figure is here. Unfortunately, when you have data where the human inter-annotator agreement is that low, the system performance tends to be even lower, and 64% is the best system performance we've been able to get so far on data that's tagged with WordNet, fine-grained WordNet sense tags. And that's pretty bad performance. That's not really going to be very useful for any kind of a system. So here, to give you an example, these are some of the entries for call in WordNet. The first one, they named their son David. The second one, call somebody on the telephone. The third one, he called me an idiot. He called me a bastard. And then the fourth one, call someone to the director's office or call the police. Okay. So this is the one, this is called the police, this is what do you call a successful movie, where you associate an attribute with something. And then the other two are, you know, very standard usages. There's 28 senses in all. There are verbs in WordNet that have 60 or 70 different senses. And some of them, sometimes it's hard, the senses can be very fine-grained. The differences can be very subtle. Sometimes it's hard to figure out why they even have two different entries. So another one of the entries in call is, I would not call her pretty. That's, I forget, since 18 or something like that. And I've never been able to figure out how that's supposed to be different from this three, except, well, one has a noun and one has an adjective, but, you know, they're both associating attributes with someone. So that's part of the reason why it's hard to get good inter-annotator agreement, because what do you call a successful movie? One tagger might have tagged it with since 3, and the other person would have tagged it with 19, since 19. So one of the things we decided to do with Sense Eval 2 was to try grouping the WordNet senses together to get kind of more coarse-grained sense distinctions, but sense distinctions that we hoped would be more obvious, where the differences would be less subtle. So, in fact, so here's WordNet 3 and WordNet 19. Those are the two I was just talking about. We added WordNet 1, the one about calling your son David, to that group. Now, we're not saying that those are exactly the same meaning. Obviously, giving somebody a name is different from associating an attribute with them. But they seemed quite closely related, and they seemed closer to each other than to anything else. And then we also added 22 is the one about, you can call me sir or mister. So that, again, that's sort of like an honorific title. It's similar to a name, naming somebody something. This is calling people on the phone or the radio. This is calling the police or calling someone to the director's office. Bird calls, people calls, and so on. So this is not the only way you could group these senses together. There are other ways you could do it. In fact, if you look at the relationship between this and PropBank, so those are grayed out because they didn't occur in the data. And then here are the PropBank frame sets for call. So they're actually pretty close. Oops, sorry. They're not exactly the same, but they were pretty close. These were done by different groups of people at a different period in time, but luckily it was all done with the same data. So it was quite easy to check to see how well they corresponded. In fact, most of the time, this is what you get, that there'll be a verb like develop has two different prop bank frame sets. Two of the WordNet sense groups correspond to one frame set, and the other two correspond to the other frame set. So 95% of the time, if two different WordNet senses are in the same group, according to our grouping, they'll also be correspond to the same prop bank frame set. So what you've got is a sort of hierarchical set of sense distinctions, where you start with the very coarse-grained prop bank frame sets based on different numbers of arguments. Then the groupings get sort of subdivide those a bit, and then at the bottom you've got the WordNet groupings. And so we've taken, if you think of this as a kind of very fuzzy, soft clustering, we've taken three different slices through this sort of semantic net of different meanings of the verb, all of which are related to each other in some fashion or the other. There are lots of other slices you could take through the same space that would give you different groupings. But this, the PropBank groupings have a fairly clear criteria. It has to do with different numbers of arguments. The criteria gets fuzzier as you get more fine-grained. So one of the things that we've tried to do with the groupings is to be as explicit as possible about why these WordNet senses are being grouped together. What is it that they have in common that sets them apart from this other group of senses? And like I said, you could have done it a different way. This isn't the only way you could do the grouping, but we're hoping that this will be useful. What we have found is that system performance on the original groupings, the Sense Eval 2 groupings, was 69%, and the inter-annotator agreement was 82%. This was the same data. It had already been tagged with the WordNet senses. When we did the groupings, we just said, okay, if these two senses are in the same group, if the annotators chose, if one annotator chose one, the other one chose the other, we're going to count it as correct if they're in the same group. Since then, we've been, now we've been doing this more groupings, and we're actually giving the groups to the annotators for the tagging, so that's the sense inventory they look at. We've got, now the inter-annotator agreement is up to 90%. They're tagging about 3 or 4 times as fast as they were tagging with the WordNet senses, and the system performance is up, has gotten as high as 87%. So it's obviously a much easier task, which is what you would expect because you've got fewer choices to make. And this is also no great earth-shattering contribution to science here. Most dictionaries give you hierarchical entries for the words, where you'll have some sort of basic sense, and then you'll have specializations of that more basic sense. But it's just kind of nice, again, to have some empirical evidence that this, in fact, does seem to fit the data. Just to say a little bit about how we do the groupings. Well, in fact, the groupings, you can think of the groupings in two different ways. One is they're groupings of WordNet senses. Another way is you take the frame set and you split it into subgroups, right? So serve, there's a frame set for serve, and I'll show you some more, a little more of this in a minute, if you serve as a committee member, then you're acting or working as a committee member. So that's sort of the overall meaning. And this was split into two different groups. The second one is like he served in Congress or he served as a committee member. The first one, the subject would not be animate. The subject would be maybe something more abstract, like his freedom to make whatever choices he wanted served him well. Okay, so those would have the same prop bank labeling, the same arg0, arg1 labels, but can be split. You can sense tag them as two different senses. You might want to split a prop bank frame set by the syntactic variation of the argument. So for C, we have the frame set 0, 0, 1, which is basically the, you know, physical perception, seeing something. But you could split it into this group, which would be, can you see the bird? And that is certain, you know, definitely physical perception. And this is more abstract. Can you see whether it works? So that the object of the second one is more likely to be a sentential complement, whereas the object of the first one is likely to be just a simple noun phrase. And then here, this was, remember I talked about leave in the Wall Street Journal and how we, because it was always the CEO leaving the company in a mess, we had this third attribute. Well, if you're doing sense tagging, you might want to split that off from just leaving the room. And treat them as two separate senses. So this is just an example of the grouping for serve that we were just talking about. Given that you've got all these lexical resources and you're doing all this semantic role labeling, is it good for anything? Can we use it for doing stuff like question answering? Well, hopefully. So given something like where the grape arbor is located, and if there's a sentence in your document collection that tells you that every path from back door to yard was covered by a grape arbor and every yard had fruit trees, then you'd like to be able to recognize that this is an answer to the question, that the path being covered by the grape arbor is just telling you where they are. Here are WordNet entries for cover. I talked about this at the workshop. Was everybody at the workshop? Most people were there, I won't spend much time on this, but we grouped the cover senses the same way that we grouped the call senses. And we have prop bank mapped to VerbNet. This is how the prop bank, there was one prop bank, two prop bank frame sets. The first one matched almost all of the groups. The second one, that's the one about the reporters covering the news. And then here's the VerbNet entry for the two different covers. This is the, we just looked at those. This is the contiguous location and the fill thing. And if you, if take fill as the relevant VerbNet sense, the VerbNet class for the grape arbors covering the path, then you get the location predicate, which ties it, makes it clear that it's an appropriate answer to the question. Okay. So now just to say a little bit about mapping PropBank to FrameNet as well. So we talked about FrameNet yesterday morning. Seems like a long time ago now, doesn't it? And so this would be, so here's FrameNet, the FrameNet frame elements for inform. This is how they would map onto the PropBank semantic role labels. So the speaker would be the arg0, the addressee would be the arg1, the message would be the arg2. What we've done is we've mapped VerbNet to FrameNet because that was easier to do. We could look at an entire class and see, can this entire class map onto this entire FrameNet frame? Okay. Then, of course, we still had to look at each verb individually. But once you'd done the mapping at the class level, then if you felt, you know, as you went through the verbs, if you thought they were, you know, pretty much the same meaning, then you already had the mapping of the thematic roles to the FrameNet frame elements. You didn't have to kind of redo that for each verb. And there's a lot of verbs missing in VerbNet. There's a lot of verbs missing in FrameNet. So having done this mapping, though, this gives us a way of trying to bootstrap extensions to both resources. So if this is in VerbNet in this class, it's not in the FrameNet removing frame or the emptying frame, but it's an obvious candidate to add to both of those frames because of the fact that it's in the VerbNet class. Again, just like in mapping PropBank to VerbNet, you don't always have the same exact number of arguments. So here, VerbNet has an agent, theme, and a destination. The agent would map onto the agent in FrameNet, but it would also map onto the cause. FrameNet, just like cruise, FrameNet distinguishes between animate agents and things that are just are like natural forces or mechanical devices that are causes. Or it could be something abstract as well that could be a cause. And so here are three of the, FrameNet has three frames for cover, the overlay, which is like covering the baby with the blanket, the deal with, and that's the covering the news, and eclipse, which is covering something with the intention of concealing it. And so these were the VerbNet, these are the VerbNet classes, mapped onto the groupings, the sense groupings, and then with PropBank. These are the FrameNet frames mapped onto the same sense groupings. So three of the groupings match pretty closely. The others just aren't in FrameNet at all. And so the two frames match the first PropBank frame set. The third frame matches the other PropBank frame set. And then here's it all together, VerbNet with FrameNet. And what you're getting is not contradictory at all. These resources are really very complementary with each other. So they're everybody, this the sense about covering the baby with the blanket, that's a very sort of basic meaning of the word. Everybody cares about that, VerbNet, FrameNet, PropBank, everybody's paid attention to that one. But the information you're getting is quite consistent. And the covering the news is another one that's a pretty high profile. FrameNet and PropBank are quite consistent on that one as well. This is the only sort of outlier, and we think that that's, again, like James was saying yesterday, when you look at the you define your theory, you apply the theory to the data, and then you look at the places where it doesn't seem to work and you go back and rethink it. So that seems, this seems to be a place where we need to rethink what we've done with either PropBank or VerbNet, or maybe both. Okay, so we've got the semantic annotation, we've got the semantic roles, we've got the sense distinctions as well. Certainly enough to distinguish between call the police and calling a successful movie a blockbuster. But we're just scratching the surface. We're really just getting going with what we need to be able to do if we're going to be able to do things like question answering, information extraction, machine translation, and do it well automatically. So we've got these predicate argument structures, and we can say this one corresponds to this VerbNet class or this FrameNet frame. But we now, having recognized the individual predicate argument structures, what we need to be able to link them together, and we need to be able to say what their relationships with the other predicate argument structures are. So basically, we need to identify the events that are being described, which events can be composed to make a larger event, and what are the temporal and causal and other kinds of relationships between these the events. So I want to talk a little bit about something we've been working on, a parallel, PropBank 2, we call it. So this is the just an example of a basic PropBank predicate argument structure, Mr. Bush meeting somebody privately in the White House. And here's a more sort of logical representation of really the same thing. And the difference here is primarily just that this is identified as an event, okay, that this is a meeting event. And it has the ARG0, the ARG1, and the location and the time. And we want to be able to do that for all the predicate argument structures in PropBank and in non-bank. I mentioned that Adam Myers is doing the argument annotation for nouns as well. You want to say, basically associate unique identifiers with each event, and then you can use those identifiers for expressing the relationships between the events. This sort of PropBank 2 included the sense tagging that I was just talking about, the kind of more coarse-grained sense tagging, the grouping of WordNet senses. And then if you're going to be identifying events, it's crucial that you can do the coreference between events, well, between nominals and some of those coreferences are entity coreferences and some of them are event coreferences. And then there are all kinds of discourse connectives that are giving you information, temporal and causal information, but other kinds of information about how these things are related. So all of this needs to be done. So with respect to whether or not things are events, you tend to think of verbs as introducing events and nouns as introducing entities. But nouns can also introduce events. So here's an example. Development can have two different meanings in English. One is where you're talking about this would be an entity, the housing development. Like this development that includes the hotel, okay, is an entity that can be referred to. But you can also talk about a development as a process or an activity which is an event or a situation. So the development of the plan took only 10 years. So one of the things that we've been doing with the sense tagging, we've been doing tagging the verbs at Colorado, ISI is tagging the nouns, and they're tagging all of the instances of development in the corpus as either event instances or not event instances. And then you can also, there are verbs that don't necessarily introduce an event, like an aspectual verbs, new loans continued to slow. There's really only one thing happening here. The loans are slowing. So you don't want to have a continue event and a slowing event. There are also light verbs, like when I talked about the executives gave the chefs a standing ovation. So that's one. I mean, if you decided to treat ovation as a nominalization, like Adam did, then that would be an event, and then the giving would also be an event. But you don't want to have two events in that sentence. You just want to have one event. So if you're going to tag the ovation as an event, then you want the give to be a light verb, and you want it. You don't want it to. So you want it to lose its events, the event status it would otherwise have. So, for instance, with the new loans continued to slow, you've got two different predicate argument structures here, but you only want to assign an event ID to say to the loans. I mean the slowing of the loans. And then the continue would just get some other kind of a identifier, and its argument would be the event, which is the slowing of the loans. So one of the main things we did with Prop Bank 2 was identify the eventuality arguments. So here's another example. The Society for Savings Bank Corps saw its stock rise. So what the society saw is this event in which the stock is rising. And a successor wasn't named, which fueled speculation that Mr. Bernstein may have clashed with S.I. Newhouse Jr. So what the not naming the successor is what fueled the speculation. So the event of not naming the successor is what fueled the speculation. Are there any questions about this? Is this clear? Any questions? I see nothing but blank faces. So maybe it's not clear. But nobody can figure out exactly how to phrase a question. Should I say something more about this example? Go back to the previous example? Yes? Yes.
How does this respond to the syntax? Like, if you take normal, if you have normal arguments, what event, position of the argument, you would have pretty well mapping of the R0 or 1 argument to the syntax. But it would be better, right? This is an initial syntactic way of rewriting.
No, actually, the syntax and the semantic row leveling are exactly the same thing we've been talking about all along. They don't change a bit. It's just for each predicate argument structure, okay? So every time you do the semantic row labeling, you do it for a particular verb, right? So let me go back. So here, okay? So every set of semantic row labels are associated with the rel up there, the relation, with a particular relation. All we're doing is assigning unique identifiers to these relations, to the verb with its associated arguments. And some of those unique identifiers we're saying are events, and some of them we're saying are not events. But we're not, I mean, this doesn't in any way change what the syntactic parse looks like or what the semantic row labels look like. It's really just whether you're calling this unique identifier an E for event or a something else. Just some kind of, just this, like an R or an M or something for relate, you know, argument labeling. Yeah. I don't remember why we called it M1. It's just something, it's not E. It just means not E. I don't, yeah, I don't remember why we call it, because it's not aspectual. Like, it could have been a one, would have been aspectual verb, you know. So the aspectual verbs are things like, I think I had some more here, are verbs like continue, start, begin, verbs that give you temporal information about the event. But they're not really giving you any other content. They're just saying, you know, we started bowling, or we started going bowling. But the going bowling is telling you what we were actually doing. So you don't want that to be two different events. So in the sentence, the society saw its stock rise. I mean, it could have been the society saw the society. Well, let's see. How about let's change it to the executives of the Society for Savings Bank Corps. Okay, saw a. Saw a flag across the street. Okay, so the executives are in the bank building. They saw a flag across the street. They're not. They're just seeing, and that flag is an entity. That's a physical perception. They're just seeing, you know. It's a visual perception of some particular thing across the street. But this is quite different because what they're seeing here is itself. An event or a situation. They saw the stock rise. Okay, so for one thing, it's abstract. There's no, I mean, maybe they did look in the paper and they saw each day that the stock prices were higher. But what we're really talking about here is that they observed the fact that the stock was rising. Okay, so it's what's being seen is itself. An activity or an event, rather than just a thing. So you could represent this as. Is there the red one? This red one? This red one? So you could just represent it like this, okay? So the second argument, so here's saw, or I guess I could have said see. So the bank sees the rising of the stock, okay? Where this is itself a predicate argument structure. So, I mean, in a way, all we're doing is just simplifying it a little bit. So we're saying, well, let's call this the rising of the stock E23, and then we can just say the bank saw E23. E23 is this the event of the stock rising. But in order to do all this, it's important to distinguish between the prop bank relations with semantic row labels that are events and the ones that are not events. So I just go back. Oh, dude, we're doing good. And you know, I'll say a little bit about this coreference. I think Massimo Poesio is going to talk a lot more about coreference. Okay, so you can think of this. Don't worry if you don't get the details. He'll tell you more than you ever wanted to know about it. You can think of this as kind of just a sneak preview or a commercial for why it's important to pay lots of attention when he's talking about coreference. Like I said, if you're worrying about detecting events, you want to detect any references to those events as well. So we did a certain amount of coreference tagging while we were doing this. But but we restricted ourselves. I mean, when you start doing co-reference, there are a whole bunch of things you have to think about. So this, John spent 3 years in jail in that time. Okay, so that time is referring to the 3 years that he spent in jail, right? That's a definite reference. But Morrill Hall, which is, say, a college dormitory, does not have a bathroom, or it's in a funny place. This it is sort of this bathroom that doesn't exist. So that's not really a definite reference to something that's been introduced into the discourse. I mean, well, actually, it has been introduced to the discourse, but it's not a reference to something that has a extension. So we didn't do those kinds. So we did things like, John Smith arrived yesterday. He said, okay, so you want to know that the he is John Smith. Many companies raised their payouts, so that their refers to the many companies. Slowing the economy is supported by some federal officials. It is repudiated by others. The it here is referring to this event, slowing the economy. Okay, so we did those kinds of event references. And then this is a generic, I like books, they make me smile. We didn't do these kinds of references. I think we'll probably just skip this free trace stuff. So we did this kind of annotation for English and for Chinese. So we have a parallel prop bank. We did all this English Chinese prop bank stuff. At the same time we were doing that, we were also doing a Chinese tree bank. So we got done with tree bank, we prop banked it. So of course, to do a Chinese prop bank, you have to have Chinese frame files, just like we created for the English. And the Chinese tree bank, the first 100,000 words of it is Shenhua News from Beijing. We translated that into English, and that was our parallel Chinese English data that we used for doing this prop bank too. The Chinese tree bank is now, we've already released the 500,000 words. The second half of it, 250,000 words, is a Taiwanese news magazine that is published in English and Mandarin. So we have parallel English data for the second half of the Chinese tree bank. So we've been prop banking that too. But we haven't done this event ID stuff on that second half yet. And since then we've done another 200,000 words of broadcast news that's been tree banked and will be prop banked as well. So you get all the same phenomena in Chinese that you get in English. There are some aspectual verbs in Chinese where we decide not to mark that predicate argument structure as an event. So this is the Chinese with the gloss, and the translation is something like, this year the Bank of China will continue to play the main role in supporting foreign invested businesses. So you've got continue as a verb, and then playing the support, this playing at supporting foreign businesses. So this is only one event here, the playing event. It's not, the continue is not a separate event. Yes, that's a very good question. So you're saying that this should probably, that the question is this whole thing tagged as just one event, or do we have play as an event and support as a separate event? I would have to ask Nian Wan Chu, but we certainly could have treated it as one event. That's possible. We also have nominalizations in Chinese. And so, in fact, here's an example of development again. And this development would be tagged as an event. But there would be one event, not the continue would not be a second event. There would just be one event here. So In fact, one of the things you see a whole lot when you're looking at translating English to Chinese is that something that is a verb in one language will be a nominalization in the other language. Just, and you know, it'll have a different syntactic structure. So by tagging these things as events and getting the predicate argument structure, it gives you, you're sort of abstracting away from the syntax and getting at a more abstract representation where it's easier to see that these, that you've got these two events could be lined up with each other. It's still a very, very long way from an interlingua representation. Okay, but both the representations are quite language specific, the English representations and the Chinese representations. You can get event coreference. So in English, I'd have to have the preceding sentence really for you to see how that's an event representation, but let's see if the Chinese one is better. These achievements have been applied to production by enterprises to spin gold from straw, which greatly improved the production level of China's nickel industry. So so applying the achievements to production is what's improving the production level of China's industry. So this is this pronoun here, which in Chinese is actually a dropped argument. So there's an empty argument there, is referring to the event of applying the achievements. On average, Chinese has, thank goodness, much lower polysemy than English does. So what you get with Chinese is a lot, the verbs tend to be compound structures with like two or three characters for a particular verb expression. There's a lot of controversy over do you treat the whole thing as the verb itself, or is it really just the first character that's the verb, and then second and third characters are giving you additional information? But most modern Chinese dictionaries these days do treat the entire expression as a separate entry in the dictionary. So we felt comfortable in going ahead and doing that as well. And that gives you much lower polysemy. So on average of 3.5 senses. We took the 20 most frequently occurring, the 30, yeah, I can't remember, 20 or 30 most frequently occurring verbs in the Chinese tree bank, and their average polysemy was 3.5. Whereas when we did the same thing with English, the average polysemy was, 16 or 17 senses. And there are, well, that's not that different. About the same number that have more than two frame sets. So we're, one of the things we've really just started looking at is how well do the groupings map between English and Chinese? Do they do the same kinds of sense distinctions? So hopefully we'll have something to say about that soon. So here's one example. This is for, the verb is raise, okay? And then these are these are all possible translations of raise from English to Chinese, and then they've been grouped together. So raise has at least four different senses. One would be increase, another would be, raise the price, increase the price. This would be like raise funds or raise taxes. You could raise, I could raise this chair by lifting it up. And there's an example. So here are the Chinese sentences that correspond to the different these different expressions. And I think these slides are going to be on the webpage tonight. I think I'll just, anybody who's interested is welcome to take a look at this and see if these make sense, and they seem to be corresponding to what you expect. I've been saying discourse connectives are also very important. There's a project at Penn, Arvind Joshi has been running for some years now, tagging all of the discourse connectives in the pin tree bank. So things like while, during, however, because are all discourse connectives, and these things have a structure of their own. They have arguments. If you see, you know, this is because of that. This happened while something else was happening. So those have all been tagged in English. We've done some, started looking at how to do the same kind of thing for Chinese. I think here's the web page. If you're interested in the discourse connectives, there's several publications on that and several good web pages. This is the information about the English and Chinese prop banks. So one of the, James Pustyowski and I have a new NSF grant working with Adam Myers with Nonbank. So James has been doing something called Time Bank, which is annotation of temporal relations. And it's sort of assuming that you already know what the events are. So he's saying, you know, if this happened while something else was happening, then there's an include temporal relation between these two events. So prop bank with the event IDs tells you what the events are. Luckily, he's tagged some of the same data that I've tagged, so what we need to do now is make sure that the way we've done this tagging is actually compatible, that the temporal relations, you can look at the temporal relations as existing between the events that we've been tagging in prop bank. And then you do want to treat all these things as real propositions and not just predicate argument structures and not just event representations. You want to know if they're conditional or if they've actually happened, if they're hypothetical. That's something that nobody has really started working on yet, but it's obviously something that needs to be done. I have one more slide after this one. I'll just end with this. I want to give you an example of this sentence, what a representation would be that identifies all the events in it's actually two sentences. In these two sentences, identifies the events and finds the relations between them. Okay? And this is a system that's being developed by Stephen Bethard, a student at Colorado, and he's using James's time bank annotation. He's using prop bank and non-bank and FrameNet, and everything basically that he can get his hands on, the pen tree bank discourse connectives, in order to produce this representation. So the White House said President Bush has approved duty-free treatment for imports of certain types of watches that aren't produced in significant quantities in the United States, the Virgin Islands, and other U.S. possessions. Okay, so there's an approve event, right? Duty-free treatment is what is being approved, and it's duty-free treatment for imports of watches, right? The action came in response to a petition filed by Timex Incorporated for changes in the U.S. generalized system of preferences. Previously, watch imports were denied such duty-free treatment. So the first thing that happened is that the watch imports were denied duty-free treatment. Then Timex filed a petition, right? Then, as a response to the petition, the approval came. Okay? So, I don't know how well you can see this, but this is the approval, okay? It came after the filing of the petition, okay? The petition was for changes in the U.S. system. The petition was by Timex. And you know what's not on here is the denial, the original denial. Okay, so that really should be down here somewhere. And it should say that the petition that the denial preceded the petition. Okay? But the petition was in response, I'm sorry, the approval, this is the approved action here. It's in response to the petition. It was requested by Timex. It was approved by President Bush. What was approved is that's the duty-free treatment up there. And all of this was said by the White House, this whole thing. And the duty-free treatment was also requested. And the watches are covered by certain classifications, yes. Sure, why not? Yeah, well, this is just to make it readable. Okay, so really, this would be the same thing. So the arg zero of Timex would point, these would be, think of this as three-dimensional, and these things get stuck together somewhere on the other side of that wall. So this is the sort of thing we want to be able to do with sentences like that. But we need is a whole lot more time bank training data. We really need to have the whole prop bank annotated. And we need all the co-reference information. We need to know, be able to identify events reliably. And then this is just the temporal information. There's you know, a lot more information about events and their relationships with each other. So you should all be feeling very optimistic right now. You're all going to have jobs for a long time in order to do all this. Okay, thank you very much.